You're tuned to WFHB.
Volunteer powered.
Listener supported.
Community radio from South Central Indiana.
Welcome to WFHB's Daily Local News.
Written and produced entirely by volunteers from the Bloomington community and supported by the generosity of listeners like you.
Good afternoon from the studios of Community Radio 91.3 FM, reporting live for WFHB. This is Carolyn Vandeweel.
And I'm Benedict Jones. This is the Daily Local News for Thursday, October 25th, 2018.
I don't think very many people think that it will revive the coal industry. I think that the effect will be minimal. We may see some coal power plants stay online a little bit longer.
In today's feature report, Professor Sonia Carley of Indiana University's School of Public and Environmental Affairs discusses the economics of coal and renewable energies with WFHB's Norm Holy.
And earlier this week, San Francisco approved a measure to allow for non-citizens to vote in municipal elections. Our weekly public opinion feature, Voices in the Street, asks if residents would support a similar measure in Bloomington. That's coming up later in the program. But first, your daily headlines.
President Donald Trump will visit Indianapolis to speak at the annual Future Farmers of America, or FFA, convention this Saturday. The president is expected to give the keynote address in front of tens of thousands at the Bankers Life Fieldhouse in downtown Indianapolis. This year's expo is the 91st FFA convention. The FFA reportedly has well over 500,000 members. The nonprofit encourages agricultural and technical knowledge and skill building among teenagers. President Trump is expected to address the Future Farmers of America this weekend and deliver an address about recent trade developments with China and their potential impact on American farmers. Only members and guests of the FFA will be able to attend President Trump's address. The speech will be streamed at ffa.org.
Indiana residents voting in the upcoming midterm elections will have to answer three public questions on their ballot. The first public question is a proposed change to the Indiana State Constitution, while the other two ask if two judges in statewide voting jurisdictions will keep their offices. The first public question is a proposed amendment to the Indiana State Constitution. If the amendment passes, the state budget cannot exceed estimated revenues without a supermajority of two-thirds of the members of the State House of Representatives and two-thirds of the members of the State Senate. Simply, the state couldn't spend more money than it thinks it's going to receive without a special vote from the legislature. The Indiana State Teachers Association has released a statement urging voters to vote no on the issue, saying it's overly simplistic and it doesn't give the state enough room to, quote, get through tough economic times, unquote.
Both of the judges in statewide voting jurisdictions on the ballot were appointed by former Governor Mike Pence. Court of Appeals 2nd District Robert Altus Jr. was appointed in 2015, and Jeffrey Slaughter joined the Indiana Supreme Court in 2016. Slaughter is an alumnus of Indiana University, receiving his bachelor's degree, an MBA in finance, and his law degree, all in Bloomington. He served as special counsel to the Attorney General of Indiana from 1995 to 2001. Slaughter worked in business law in Indianapolis before his 2016 appointment to the Indiana Supreme Court by former Governor Mike Pence. The other judge on the ballot, Altus Jr., began his legal career as a prosecutor. He started in Jackson County, Missouri, as a deputy prosecutor for a drug unit before eventually moving to Indianapolis and joining the prosecution in Marion County. In Indiana, Altus Jr. tried more than 100 felony jury trials, including 25 murders. He then served as a Marion County Superior Court judge for 14 years before being appointed to the Indiana Court of Appeals by Pence. Even though both Altus Jr. and Slaughter were appointed in the last 5 years, their seats are up to a vote in what's called a retention ballot. Indiana judges have to stand for retention at the first statewide general election after serving for 2 full years. If they are kept in office, then it will be another 10 years before Indiana residents vote to keep them on the bench or not.
Indiana Senators Joe Donnelly and Todd Young were behind a bipartisan bill to address the opioid epidemic. WFHB correspondent Gabe Donnelly brings a report on the Bipartisan Support Act.
President Donald Trump signed an opioid epidemic bill into law yesterday. The bipartisan bill, called the Support Act, aims to boost access to addiction treatment, lift restrictions on medications, expand the use of non-opioid alternatives in Medicare, and many other policy changes. Indiana Democratic Senator Joe Donnelly spoke on the Senate floor last month about provisions he added to the bill. President Trump signed all of Senator Donnelly's proposed provisions into law on Wednesday. One of those provisions expands the use of non-opioid alternative medications available in Medicare. That provision is named in honor of Dr. Todd Graham, a consulting physician at the University of Notre Dame in South Bend. Dr. Graham was murdered last year for refusing to prescribe opioids to one of his patients. Donnelly's second provision to the Support Act offers debt relief to healthcare workers in opioid crisis areas. The Support Act offers up to $250,000 in student loan debt relief after 6 years of working in an opioid-affected community. Donnelly and Indiana Republican Senator Todd Young's bipartisan provisions included measures to help non-addictive pain medications get to patients more quickly. This bipartisan legislation becomes law as the midterm elections draw nearer. Both Republicans and Democrats in the Senate worked on the Support Act. According to the Centers for Disease Control, nearly 2,000 residents in Indiana died last year from a drug-related overdose. For WFHB, I'm Gabe Donnelly.
Halloween is just around the corner, and for the 17th year in a row, the Monroe County Probation Department and the Department of Corrections will require sex offenders on probation to attend a mandatory meeting on Halloween. WFHB reporter Annie Aguiar has more.
While children are out trick-or-treating next Wednesday, one population won't be on the streets: Bloomington's convicted sex offenders. Operation Safe Halloween is a collaboration between the local probation department and the Department of Corrections. Sex offenders on probation are required to attend a mandatory meeting on Halloween night. The meeting lasts during the city's trick-or-treat hours, from 5:30 p.m. to 8:30 p.m., and is held in the Charlotte T. Zeitlow Justice Center in downtown Bloomington. Monroe County's Chief Probation Officer Linda Brady says that the program is mainly a public safety initiative.
It just sounded like a good idea to us. Didn't really cost any money. It basically provided the community that extra feeling of safety to know that the convicted sex offenders are not out and about during trick-or-treat hours, and also some protection for them, the offenders. So if there was something that happened, hopefully it doesn't, but if something did, we would know where they were all during those hours.
This is the 17th year since the Probation Department and the Department of Corrections adopted the program after seeing community concern and other cities with similar strategies for Halloween supervision.
Many years ago, we had some citizens who were very concerned about sex offenders who could be out and about during trick-or-treat hours, and a couple of other communities around the nation started this Safe Halloween operation with probation and parole clients. So we decided to start that program ourselves 17 years ago.
Not every sex offender in the city will be attending. Brady says 21 sex offenders on probation and 10 on parole will be at the meeting. Sex offenders on probation have to attend the meeting, while it's voluntary for those on parole. Paroled sex offenders can either attend or have home visits and phone calls from parole agents. Sex offenders staying in for the night are advised to turn off outside lights, not display Halloween decorations, and post signs saying they're not passing out candy. The meeting isn't supposed to be a punishment. The probation department will be showing a movie to the group, like they've done in the past. The movie chosen, however, isn't very in touch with the Halloween spirit.
We don't do horror movies because usually that's violent, and so you don't want to show violent movies to a group of sex and violent offenders. So no, it could be Secretariat. I can't remember what it was last year, but no, we don't show violent movies or R-rated or any of that.
This year's movie pick is the 2010 Academy Award Best Picture winner, The King's Speech. For WFHB, I'm Annie Aguiar.
You're listening to the Daily Local News on WFHB. Reporting live, I'm Benedict Jones.
And I'm Carolyn Vandeweel. Support for WFHB is provided by attorneys Eric Slotograph and Ben Neoff. Slotograph Neoff is located at 200 East 3rd Street in downtown Bloomington, assisting families and small businesses in meeting the legal challenges of life, providing estate planning and wills, as well as family law services. More information is available at 812-332-6000 or online at slotographlegal.com. Slotograph Neoff, law for business, community, and life.
In today's feature report, Professor Sonia Carley of Indiana University's School of Public and Environmental Affairs discusses the economics of coal and renewable energies with WFHB's Norm Holy.
Thank you for having me. So the economics of coal in general and coal power plants, we are at a place in market conditions where coal is a declining industry. Coal production is declining, but also plans for future power plants are thin. We don't have very many in development, and we don't have many planned over the next 10 to 15 years across the country. So clearly, coal is a declining industry, and the question then is, what is the reason behind that? What are the factors? And I would say generally that, of course, policy and regulation might play a role in the decline of the coal industry, but that's far less significant than general market dynamics or other market trends that are happening simultaneously within the electricity industry. And these trends are primarily the increase of natural gas and of renewables, particularly wind and solar. So as the price of natural gas and wind and solar have all come down, capacity expansion in all three of these areas has gone up significantly, and these resources essentially have crowded out coal generation. So the leading reason that the coal industry is declining is because of these competitor resources.
Trump has been wanting to remove regulations. I mean, is that actually going to revive the coal industry, or will that not have much of an effect?
I don't think very many people think that it will revive the coal industry. I think that the effect will be minimal. We may see some coal power plants stay online a little bit longer and not retire as soon as one might have expected. But we're still not going to see a resurgence in coal. We're also not going to see a resurgence in plans for developing new coal power plants. So I don't anticipate that these changes will fundamentally affect the market potential for coal.
How do the costs compare for coal-fired electricity versus natural gas-fired or solar or wind?
Well, it depends on who you ask and which information you use. It depends also on what kind of metrics you use, whether you're using a levelized cost of electricity or some other metric. But the majority of estimates nowadays actually do not show coal to be the cheapest resource anymore. Coal is more expensive than these competitive resources, such as natural gas, which is much cheaper, wind is much cheaper, and solar is on the decline. This one really depends on which estimate you're using. Some might put it a little above coal, some might put it below coal. But within the next couple of years, as the price of solar continues to decline, we'll most likely see it below coal.
One of the issues in solar is battery, or however you store the energy that's produced.
Well, yeah, you're exactly right. The industry at large has developed significantly over the last decade. The price of storage and the types of storage technologies that are available have advanced so much. So there are no perfect storage options that are out there right now, but I think within the next several years we'll see some really great options that might actually be price competitive.
I'd like to have you comment on a couple of those approaches to storage. Is there a clear winner evolving in that whole competition?
No, I don't think at this point there's a clear winner, but I think you're exactly right that there are a variety of different alternatives. So the ones that you mentioned, one would be more of a kind of a conventional storage for electricity. The other that you mentioned is pumped hydroelectric storage. So again, as you noted, pulling water up to an upper reservoir and then releasing it at times when the electricity is needed. So those are both great options. They're used in different applications. I think it's also important to think about the scale of different storage options. So as we continue to deploy smaller scale, more distributed resources such as solar for residential applications, we'll see the increased use of smaller scale, kind of what's referred to as behind the meter storage, which is sitting essentially at somebody's residence so that they're able to use that storage application in conjunction with their solar, or they might have an electric vehicle, for example, and they can actually tap into the battery of the electric vehicle and give and take electricity as needed. So there are a variety of different storage options, and they run the gamut in terms of scale as well.
Speaking of vehicles, I know you've worked on the economics of electric vehicles. Tell us what your findings are.
Sure, I'd be happy to. Let me just tell you a little bit about how I've approached electric vehicles. And that's one, primarily from the consumer side, and that's thinking about which consumers are interested in electric vehicles and what characteristics predict interest within a consumer, within an individual, so what makes one more or less likely to want to purchase an electric vehicle. And also some research on policies and which policies we have in place for electric vehicles, and thinking through how these policies might lead to the deployment or not of electric vehicles. So some of the leading findings are that consumers, kind of the early adopter consumers, tend to be more highly educated. They tend to be more concerned about environmental issues and climate change, and they're particularly interested in newer technologies and technological development, or at least being a pioneer, if you will, in technology development. On the policy side, we find that many of the policies that we have in place, particularly the federal level tax credit, as well as some of the state grant programs that are available for electric vehicles, are highly effective at increasing the rate of deployment of electric vehicles. We also find that the ZEV program, which is the Zero Emission Vehicle Program, which is present in California as well as 9 other states throughout the country, this is essentially a percentage mandate for electric vehicles. We find that this ZEV program at this point has not yet led to an increase in electric vehicles in the places where it's instituted. But this program is kind of ratcheting up in intensity over time, so we would expect that as this mandate becomes tighter, that it would become more effective at deploying electric vehicles in those very specific states.
I'd like to thank you very much for the interview.
Thank you very much for your time. I appreciate it.
And we just heard WFHB correspondent Norm Holey speaking with IUSPIA Professor Sonia Carley about the role of coal power generation. Support for WFHB comes from listeners like you and from the IU Health Foundation, where local gifts stay local, serving patients for a healthier Bloomington.
Support also comes from MPI Solar, a Bloomington business specializing in solar hot water, solar electricity, and solar hot air systems. MPI Solar designs and installs solar power generation systems that encourage independence and individual responsibility. Found locally at 812-334-4003 and on the web at mpisolarenergy.com.
The U.S. Forest Service is planning on conducting some 18 prescribed burns across the Hoosier National Forest. The Forest Service announced that they are planning to burn some 4,500 acres of land in the state's only national forest this fall. The burns will take place in Jackson, Martin, Orange, and Perry counties in south central Indiana. The exact dates of the burns are dependent on weather conditions and the dryness of the area. The National Forest Service is expecting to complete most of its burns before spring, but says it's possible they may have to resume burning forest areas if a particularly wet fall in south-central Indiana occurs. Wind direction is often a limiting factor due to adjacent roads or private homes. And each of the areas has been identified to improve wildlife habitat or to restore woodlands. In some cases, wetlands, woodlands, or barrens are being restored. In others, the fire is used to enhance oak hickory regeneration or to maintain early successional habitat in wildlife openings. For additional information about the burns, contact the U.S. Forest Service offices in Bedford.
Indiana Attorney General Curtis Hill appealed to the Supreme Court last Friday, Hill is asking the nation's highest court to implement restrictions on abortion. Those increased restrictions were passed by the state legislature during then-Governor Mike Pence's administration in 2016. The abortion statutes, called House-Enrolled Act 1337, seeks to prohibit women in the state from getting an abortion because of a fetus's developmental disability or race. A second part of House-Enrolled Act 1337 also sought for women who receive an abortion to bury or cremate their fetal remains. In two separate legal challenges, regional appeals courts struck down both measures of HEA 1337. The Seventh Circuit Appeals Court cited federal Supreme Court decisions on increasing abortion regulations, including cases like Roe v. Wade, which have found states should not further regulate a woman's constitutional right to her body. Indiana Attorney General Curtis Hill's request for the Supreme Court to take up HEA 1337 comes after the second appointment to the bench by President Donald Trump.
And up next, our weekly public opinion segment, Voices in the Street.
Welcome to Voices in the Street, WFHB's weekly public opinion feature. Voices in the Street provides an opportunity for people in our community to share their opinions and perspectives on the issues and events that matter most to Bloomington residents.
San Francisco recently passed an ordinance allowing non-citizens to vote in local elections. Voices in the Street asked area listeners if they would support a similar measure here in Bloomington. Do you feel that non-citizens should have the right to vote?
No, not really. If you're born in the U.S., you should be able to vote for why you live here and everything. Like, then in that case, yeah, it affects them too. The laws apply to them the same way.
I don't agree with it. I've got a fiance that is going to be here next year, and she's not a citizen and won't be until we do the process. And we were talking yesterday about the election and how it'll be a few years until she's able to vote. And there's a process, and there's a process for a reason. So I agree with going with the process, just as we're going with the process to get her here. And it's not an easy process, a fun one, but we're doing it the legal route and taking the process.
I don't know a lot about this, but I think yes. Voting is a civic right, and you should be able to have a say in what's going on.
I mean, as long as, you know, a person pulls their weight, that they should be able to do what they need to do to survive.
If they're living here, let them vote. If they're living here and they're, like, you know, under the laws and stuff, they should be able to, you know, choose who makes those laws. Like I'm all for it.
Part of being a citizen, the right to vote, isn't that part of the, being part of a free society, you have to be a citizen to vote? Mm-hmm. I can't go to Mexico and vote, right? Mm-hmm. So I think you should be a citizen to vote.
I was not aware of that, but I would have to say no. I think we need to be citizens to vote for our country representatives.
I do not believe that a non-citizen should have the right to vote. There's a due process to become a citizen in this country, and I feel like, you know, as long as that's followed properly, then you should have every right to become a citizen and thus vote at your own choosing.
If they're not citizens, it's not technically a right. I think that we need to probably make the path to citizenship a little bit easier, specifically for non-citizens. But I think to have the right to vote is to be a citizen. So if you're not a citizen, I don't think it's the right to vote.
No, mainly just because they're not a citizen of our country. So I feel like you should be a citizen of the United States if you're going to vote for the United States government. I honestly don't know much about the process, but I've heard that it's pretty difficult, and I think, yeah, probably it should. I'm sorry, I'm not too knowledgeable on the topic, honestly.
Nonsense. I believe that we need to take care of people here first and get voting rights restored to people who are incarcerated, you know, felonies. I believe that there should be a pathway for people to vote when they are participating in our system.
Maybe, yeah, I could see it. Really, anybody in America would be fine, I assume. Yeah.
It's kind of like, well, if they care enough to vote, then yes, we have so many people who have the right to vote, but they don't exercise it, yet they'll go out and buy a lottery ticket and have a greater chance of being struck by lightning and not vote because they say their voice doesn't matter.
Nope, because they're not a citizen. It's as simple as that, really.
This has been Voices in the Street, WFHB's weekly public opinion segment, featuring candid commentary from your friends and neighbors on the issues and events that matter most to Bloomington residents. Voices in the Street is a volunteer-powered production of our News and Public Affairs Department here on WFHB 91.3 and 98.1 FM, community radio for South Central Indiana.
You've been listening to the Daily Local News on WFHB. Today's headlines were written by Annie Aguiar and Gabe Donnelly, along with Sarah Vaughn for Cats Week, a partnership with Community Access Television Services. Our feature was produced by Wes Martin.
Voices in the Street was produced by Isaac Gonzalez. Our engineer today is Dan Withard. Our theme music is provided by Ben Lumsdaine, Scott Schmadke, and Danny Graff. Executive producer is Wes Martin. For WFHB, this is Benedict Jones.
And I'm Carolyn Vandeweel. Thanks for supporting Indiana's only volunteer-powered, independent daily news program.
Stay tuned for Big Talk with Michael Glab, a WFHB news and public affairs program highlighting the issues, events, and people in South Central Indiana. That's coming up next, right here on WFHB.
You've been listening to the Daily Local News on WFHB Bloomington Community Radio. Our news is written and reported by volunteers working to provide local news, cover local issues, and strengthen our local community. We invite you to participate. You may submit questions, comments, and story ideas to news@wfhb.org. You can become a Daily Local News volunteer by attending new volunteer orientation. You can find an archive of past shows and individual news reports online at wfhb.org and catch live broadcast of the Daily Local News Monday through Thursday at 5 p.m. We are local, longer.